Okay, well, I think we should start. It is supposed to start at 4, isn't it? Thank you so much, Tom. That's great. Let me just make a few introductory comments. First of all, to introduce myself, Ranald McCauley. I live in Cambridge, and I'm still a member of Labrie. I work in Labrie, but sort of outside of the bounds of the community Labrie. There is a Labrie in Hampshire. And so I've worked in that sort of community setting, which is an apologetic community. Incidentally, this is about apologetic community. and so that's my background, and that's part of my interest, that that's been the life that I've been involved in for so long. what else should I tell you about myself? Great. Yeah, well, let me go on to tell you the background to this particular workshop. It wasn't my idea. There is the culprit over there. And I was asked to do it, and I was very glad to, because it's something which is very close to my heart. Secondly, I hope to enable us all to have as much conversation as possible. So if I fail in that, excuse me. The intention is to have as much conversation as possible. Now, I'm going to deal with three headings, very simple. There is a handout, but I'm not following the handout, so it's not going to be of any value to you, okay? Well, I mean, it might be of some value in retrospect. But the first is community, the second is apologetics, and the third is apologetic community. So, community, first of all. Now, I'm going to start with a diagram to show what I believe to be behind the present crisis we face. That is, not only in terms of our own Christian experience, and not only in terms of how we relate to the culture, all of which we've been discussing and are concerned about, but even in relation to the culture as a whole. And even beyond that, I'm thinking Western society, but even beyond that, that I believe it is increasingly the crisis that faces us globally. And the diagram runs like this. I'm going back to the 18th century. Can you all see that? This is not as big a pen as I'd like, but I hope you can see that. Okay, 18th century. And this is the time of the Enlightenment, of course, which was referred to last night by Stefan and Richard. But the issue, I think, that emerged from this was not a single one, but a double one. What is sometimes called a double whammy. And this is how I read it, that what emerged from the Enlightenment was, on the one side, a philosophic attack, that's my shorthand for philosophic, phi in Greek, philosophic attack, which was naturalism. That is, that only nature exists. There are different terms for this, as you know, naturalism. And that philosophic attack has, up until the 21st century, become dominant. That view has become dominant. The attack was sustained, the victory won by humanism. This is what we all understand. What I think has not been understood sufficiently is that it was an attack which really arose out of the development of modern science. I know you all are familiar with this, forgive me, but the naturalistic philosophy gained its plausibility from the fact that modern science was so effective, and as Stefan said last night, the philosophers of the Enlightenment actually hijacked science. That's what gave it this intellectual momentum, this power, this plausibility, that it seemed, it was a deception, and this morning I was elaborating on this under the title, The Grand Deception, The Epistemological Lie. I can't dwell on that. But in my estimation, there has never been a deception, including all the idolatry of the ages, which has been more potent in terms of its effect upon the whole world than this epistemological lie, the philosophy of naturalism, and the effect that it had, so that it seemed as if no one could respond to it. And hence our dilemma today, intellectually. Okay. But my point is this, that in a sense you can say that derived from science, you have technology. And that this, clearly you see the relation in the agricultural revolution, 18th century, 19th century, industrial revolution, and you have another force at work which in a sense has got an independent existence. It doesn't depend upon this, the philosophic revolution. It is a technical, it is a practical consequence of this. And I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with that, just as there's nothing wrong with science. But the problem is that because we haven't had an adequate response to this, and I don't believe there could have been an adequate response, outside of the Christian church being really alive spiritually to grapple with this problem, the technological. And so, unhindered, without restrictions, what we find is that we have, here I'm describing it as the double whammy, we have not simply an intellectual challenge. I was focusing, those of you who were in my seminar this morning, on how we can deal with that intellectually. What is the nub of the issue, what I call the epistemological lie. Okay? But we have, at the same time, with growing intensity here, the effects into the culture, and as I say, not just in the West, but increasingly globally, which now has the effect of really destroying community. So that what in many respects appears to be progress, in actual fact, is regress. Now, look at this quotation from, I find this really very, very moving, and it's a long quote, and it's the very last paragraphs, this is what makes it so moving, it's the very last paragraphs of this book by Alistair MacIntyre. Alistair MacIntyre was a communist, a philosopher in England, later went to the States, became a Christian, wrote this famous book, After Virtue, you see, 1987. But just look what he says. He's comparing our situation with the Roman Imperium. In other words, the collapse of Rome. A crucial turning point in the earlier history occurred when men and women, note, these are the last two paragraphs of the book, men and women of good will turn aside from the task of shoring up the Roman Imperium and cease to identify the continuation of civility and moral community with the maintenance of the Imperium. What they set themselves to achieve instead, often not recognizing fully what they were doing, was the construction of new forms of community within which the moral life could be sustained so that both morality and civility might survive the coming ages of barbarism and darkness. So now, that's the background, okay? Now, if my account of our moral condition, he goes on, is correct, we ought also to conclude that for some time now, we too have reached that turning point. What matters at this stage, this I've emphasized for those of you listening to the tape, is the construction of local forms of community within which civility and the intellectual and moral life can be sustained through the new dark ages which are already upon us. And if the tradition of the virtues was able to survive the horrors of the last dark ages, we are not entirely without grounds for hope. This time, however, the barbarians are not waiting beyond the frontiers. Note this. They're not waiting beyond the frontiers. They have already been governing us for some time. And it is our lack of consciousness of this that constitutes part of our predicament. We are waiting not for a Godot, but for another, doubtless very different, St. Benedict. Now, those of you who are not familiar, again, I apologize for such a long quote, but isn't it moving that here is someone drawing a parallel between our situation and the barbarism that swept over Europe in the 5th and 6th centuries? But he's not without hope. And I don't say any of this as, you know, sort of a defeatist thing, but what he points to is the fact that small communities were developed, particularly around Benedict. He was the genius. His book, The Rule of Benedict, as it's called, is the foundation of all the monastic communities. And what is very striking is that the quotation, which is in the notes, those of you who've got your Bible to hand, you know, the Forum Bible, as I call it, we'll note that I have in there his quotation. John Roberts is a historian in the United Kingdom, very, very eminent, and then went on to Oxford, is the warden of Merton College. And he says this: at the deepest level, it is in its Christian nature that the explanation of the success of medieval society in shaping the future must lie. And then he has three things he singles out, but then this final bit: at the heart of Christianity lay always the concept of the supreme, infinite value of the individual soul. And its importance can easily be sensed by considering the absence in other great cultures, Islam, Hindu India, China, of such an emphasis. Now, I can't dwell on any of this because we've got... Excuse me. That is a quotation out of the notes, sorry, for my seminar this morning, Leaders in Society Network. So when you go back, you can look that up, okay? But my point is this. When he actually made the documentary for the BBC, which came out, I think it was 1985, this is incidentally a BBC publication, which is out of print, sadly, The Triumph of the West. But when he made his documentary, the second shot on the whole thing, I think it's about 10 episodes, is of him standing in Monte Cassino. Monte Cassino is the monastery that Benedict founded. And he stands there and just makes the simple point. He just says, this is where Europe began. The small community of men, and there were women subsequently later, his sister began a community. And so you have this sense in Roberts of recognizing just what these Christian communities did in terms of turning the whole direction of Europe away from paganism, and gradually, as they grew and extended their influence, creating what we now see as this tremendous heritage. Tremendous heritage. What was even more striking to me was now, incidentally, I'm not advocating monasticism, lest you be confused. I'm just emphasizing community and the power of community. Okay? Right. Lest you get the wrong impression. But what I found even more striking was that I came across this book by a man called Morris Berman, an American. And these are a couple of quotes from his book called The Twilight of American Culture. Can you all see that? And just elaborating on this whole theme, and I remember that I'm just taking this as a simple extract, but elaborating on this, what I call the double whammy here, but particularly emphasizing this side, the technological side, he says, one could argue that corporate consumer culture is tantamount to a kind of nuclear attack on the human mind. Now, I believe that to be the case. I feel that I believe there to be a tremendous pressure upon us as a result of what I call the double whammy effect. Not simply the ideas, but the fact that the culture is moving so fast, we have all these means of communication, which is speed up life, etc., you have community breaking down. But what I really wasn't bargaining on was this second quote. Because you won't believe it. Here is a non-Christian writer, secular writer, and he actually invents this phrase when he starts to talk about an alternative, a solution to this problem. And he has this phrase, do you see there, the new monastic individual? He actually then refers to it thereafter as an NMI, that we have to create NMIs, new monastic individuals. And again, he's not advocating monasticism, but he's saying central to all of these options is the rejection of a life based on kitsch consumerism and profit, or in power, fame, and self-promotion. The monastic option now needs to be a way of life. The monastic option. And what I take him to mean is that there has to be a stepping back, a critique of what's going on, this destruction of community, stepping back from that and somehow creating something else. And then he goes on, as the new era, starting 1989 with the fall of communism, enters its 12th year in 2000, its three defining characteristics, globalization, cybernetics, and destruction, have emerged quite clearly. Oh, brave new world, he has a little quote about that. And they are making most Americans anxious and disoriented, for they inevitably lead to lives of emptiness and futility. Remember, his title is The Twilight of American Culture. Now, I mustn't dwell on this too long, but the effect of all of this, I think, is well expressed in this quote from David Wells. Incidentally, just before I turn to that, you know the famous quote of Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. Only when I saw his obituary in the Times, when I was looking back in the university library, did I realize that the quote, the famous quote, it is the medium that is the message. Do you see that underlined? That you have it completed, because the medium creates an environment that is indelible and lethal. And his writing was to warn against this new climate that was creating, as he says, an indelible and lethal influence upon society. This is how David Wells sums it up. The choice for God now has to become one in which the church begins to form itself by his grace and truth into an outcropping of counter-cultural spirituality. So, to just continue with this first point, what I'm suggesting is that one of the aspects of our crisis as Christians confronting this particular culture in which we're living, and increasingly globally, we have to deal with this issue of community per se. For the value of the thing itself, we must devote ourselves to the recovery of community. Schaeffer used to put it like this, that there are two orthodoxies. There is the orthodoxy of doctrine, as he put it, and the orthodoxy of community. And it's that second one, you see, that I'm stressing. We have to recover community. So my first point is we need communities of all kinds, particularly the church, to recover this because of its value intrinsically. And then I will go on to argue because it is vital too in the apologetic task. I've told some of you in the room that a couple of years back I had a tremendous burden to pray for revival in the American church. Why that? Was simply because I was in the States at the time, and I had longed for some new impetus into the whole of this crisis that would turn the whole thing around, that would make a material difference. And being in the States, and it wasn't the first time I'd been there, and with my reading, I realized the potential of the American evangelical community. That if something dramatic were to happen in that constituency, really it would have an impact into the whole world, which is incalculable. So I've been praying for revival. But as I thought about that, I wondered, what could I say meaningfully to show what I meant by revival? And I think you'll see how this relates to my first point. Suddenly, as I was riding in the underground in the airport in Atlanta, these three C's stood out for me very clearly, and I'll give them to you now. You might want to write them down. If there is to be an effective revival in the United States, it seems to me it'll be characterized by these three things, and not just in the U.S. of A., for all of us, because you've already heard me say this is a universal problem, okay? But very particularly in the United States, and also because there are so many Bible-believing Christians there. And one of the marks of revival, just historically, was that it frequently came in the context of those who had a true faith, in the sense like they came from communities that knew the gospel in a certain sense and had lost the reality. You think of the revivals of the 18th century, you see. They'd lost the reality. I'm not pointing the finger, please. You know, don't misunderstand. But it just is a fact that there isn't the potency that there should be for any of us. And so the first is character, not comfort. The development of character as a priority, and largely as a result of the twin things of service and suffering. The imitatio Christi, as it's called, the imitation of Christ. Character, not comfort. Following the Master. Be imitators of me, says Paul, as I am of Christ. And how does he describe his life? You all remember, familiar with 2 Corinthians. You know, I went through all of this hassle. And above all, the pressure of all the churches. You remember the passage. Okay. Secondly, community, not commuting. Community, not commuting. All of these I see to be related, incidentally. Community, not commuting. We have to recover real community, not virtual community. Not the sort of touching of one another periodically, but actually in our communities, I mean in our localities, reconstructing the sort of community that used to exist ipso facto, because that's what society was like, and now has been so badly distorted by the rise of the second force. The third is confrontation of ideas and not compromise. Confrontation of ideas, not compromise. The sort of thing that we in Libri were engaged in, which is the apologetic task. Confrontation of ideas, not compromise. Now, in sum, just to wrap this first bit up, the importance of community, it seems to me, is first of all because it is right, biblically, and secondly, because it is necessary. Now, I'm moving towards apologetics. In terms of where we are today, philosophically, and the mix here, this potent mix, which you could describe, you know, the postmodern, the postmodern culture. In relation to that, the level of cynicism on the part of people towards ideas is immeasurable. How can you trust anyone? People are so trapped within the media, etc., within the cultural fashions, and yet, at the same time, there is this feeling like a longing, I think, for something more. That's what I mean by this desire, which can only be satisfied by real community. So, although the answers have to come in relation to this, the challenge of naturalism, and then postmodernism as well, intellectually, although they have to be met head on, unashamedly, courageously, without compromise, what I'm suggesting is that there is a combination here of these two forces which require us to have our apologetics in the context of community, of real community. Let me draw another diagram to try to clarify this. It seems to me when you compare the other area, in the other moment in time, when you had a real impact on the society and the whole thing changed. You remember Richard's point last night, we must learn from the reformers. It seems to me what they had, I keep losing my pens. I had a red one, there it is. If you draw the two aspects of the society that was not Christian, and the red, the reformers, you see how close they are. The whole issue of truth and of the interrelationship of ideas, Christian ideas, and the society, they were almost indistinguishable. That is how the society worked. And what you found at the time of the Reformation was that the reformers took on the culture intellectually, and you had, first of all, the reformers involved in apologetics. In other words, they were saying, what is true? What ideas are true? And the Catholic Church had its ideas. That was the consensus throughout Europe. And they were looking at those ideas and saying, are they right? Are they wrong? And in terms of that, they launched an attack. They took on, they confronted the prevailing ideas. They confronted the prevailing ideas. More than that, they actually debated. And I don't know if you're familiar with this, but you had people like in Switzerland, Farel, Calvin, Viret, actually involved in debates. Three speakers, either side, big cathedral. Here are the Catholics, here are the Protestants, and the Protestants just won hands down every time. That's why so much of Switzerland turned to the Protestant faith. Now, what I'm suggesting is that as a result of pietism, what you have is a situation like this, that the church has become... You see what I'm doing? You see, oh, there it is, there it is. Has distanced itself from the culture intellectually as a result of the pietistic ideas that really this is not very important. The mind must is not really central. It's the heart. And then it's the private experience and not the public, how the society is constructed, etc., the political discussions. And this distance is enormous between the church and the culture. We have allowed that to happen. It is, in a sense, our responsibility as Christians. Now, you might conclude from what I've just said that I think this is hopeless. You know, the distance is so great, we'll never bridge this gap. I believe the opposite is the case. That in a sense, I'm not underestimating the problem, the difficulty. I mean, that we've described it as a crisis. You heard Stefan, you heard Richard last night. But in a curious way, there is this parallel between the 16th century Reformation, okay, and ourselves in the 21st century. Here's the society, you know, the society and the church, and the church facing one another. But what is so striking is that at this time, there was in actual fact, as I said to those of you this morning who were here, a moral and intellectual bankruptcy within the Catholic Church. I mean, the whole of Europe knew that. That's what Erasmus was writing about. That's why Lady Margaret Beaufort in Cambridge started these two colleges, Christ College and St. John's College, forked out a huge amount of money. They were trying to deal with this moral and intellectual bankruptcy of the church. And that's exactly where we are. So my point is this. If we were, could we do this under God, if we were able to mount the same combination of things as the reformers did, and I'm not wanting to belittle all the other things that they did, you know, the faithful preaching of God's word, revising church worship, and so on and so forth, all of that. But I'm saying, if we were to do that, I believe there would just be such an interest within the culture because of its tremendous need. We were in Budapest at the meeting that was arranged last year, and one of the striking things was we watched this video of Bill Craig debating Atkins, a famous chemist in Oxford, in Atlanta, and really Atkins came away looking very foolish. Why? Is it because Bill Craig is so clever? No, because there really is no substance intellectually and morally underneath the hegemony that prevails throughout the whole of the West, this consensus, the naturalistic consensus. And we just haven't caught on that that is the case, nor have we been able to train one another to actually engage in that. Okay, so this brings me finally, I'm trying to hurry, so we have discussions, because I say, you don't want to listen to me. We want to talk, we want to have a conversation. Okay, my final then is apologetic communities. So the importance of community per se, the absolutely vital necessity of apologetics, if we are to bridge this gap between the culture, the excitement of the possibility of doing that and what it might result in, and finally apologetic communities. Now, I've touched on this to an extent already. What I mean is that we need to create models. That word is important. We need to create models in which apologetics can start to be learned and practiced. Not just learned intellectually, learned and practiced. In which apologetics can be learned and practiced. Why models? Because this is no ideal as if, you know, now we're going to solve all the problems, we're going to start these communities, and they're going to be the solution, okay? Not three knots. Not as if the development of these apologetic communities is essential. As if, you know, without this, there really couldn't be any other possibility. God could do it in other ways. And particularly if the churches were to take on this responsibility. I mean, as churches, as local churches, it could happen. So there's no necessity, secondly. But just within that, in parenthesis, just think, though, of the value of this little community which the Schaeffers began in 1955 in this tiny little village hidden up there in the mountains in Switzerland in the canton of Vaud. And they didn't even intend to start it. No big plan. There they are. And they just opened their house to people. I mean, I just listed three names here. Oz Guinness. I mean, just think of the work that he is doing now with the Wilberforce Forum. I think I've got the name right. No, which one? Trinity Forum. Thank you, darling. I knew I'd got it wrong. Oz Guinness. Oz Guinness came limping through the front door, having almost lost his faith. Outstanding student at London Bible College. I met him while he was there in his final year. And it was simply being in a community, touching this real, very imperfect, but real community, okay, in which then there was the possibility of saying, but is that true? Is it really true? And what do you say to this? And what do you say to that? And then listening to this going on with non-Christians, just as I had previously. That was basically what saved my life, too, okay, back in 1959 when I first went out there. But that is what gave him the basis upon which now he's been able to go on and then engage in this in a really wonderful ministry. The other person I I singled out, and I want to plug her very particularly, not so much for her own sake, but the book that, for the book, not, I do that for her sake, but the book that she has now written and which I've seen in manuscript form and which is due to be published by Crossway in January is called, the present title, and do watch for it. It is a gem, really, for anyone interested in apologetics. It is a gem. Nancy Pearcey, P-E-A-R-C-E-Y, and it's called Setting the Gospel Free. Setting the Gospel. I mean, I like that parallel with the 16th century. What happened then? Was it just sola scriptura, sola fide, you know, justification by faith, as if these are just ideas? No, the whole of history was affected. The whole culture, and I compared this morning England in the 17th century and what happened there, not as if they were particularly virtuous, but they were freed by the gospel in terms of political structures, as over against France just across the channel, which went very swiftly through Louis XIV into an absolutism, the consequence of which was, as Kuyper draws out in his book on Calvinism, was a kind of an imitation, trying to imitate the Reformation. You have the blow-up, the French Revolution. And you immediately go into Napoleon, and, you know, France has had 11 constitutions. 11 constitutions, because of the instability that was created at that time. So, Nancy Pearcey, her book, Setting the Gospel Free, is saying, listen, if we could re-engage, and what she does simply is she says, look, I was not a Christian. I went to Labrie. That's what happened to me. I asked these questions. They were answered. And I was set free. And now these ideas can set the whole world free, you know, just like they did at the time of the Reformation. You all get my point. It's a lovely book, and I commend you to watch out for it. And then finally, Lane Dennis, who's actually going to be the person who publishes this. His parents, Lane Dennis, he's behind the new English Standard Version, the ESV. Lane Dennis came with his brother, again, just limping along. Came in from a Christian family, nearly gave it all up. Last ditch effort, go to Labrie, and just living in that community. You know, his whole life was turned away. He went back. He said, Mom and Dad, you know, could I do something a little bit different with the publishing? And that was how Crossway was developed. I don't know if you've seen their full list. I'm not saying that every book is, you know, ideal, et cetera, et cetera. But man, in terms of apologetics, they have produced a wonderful library. Thankfully, they've given it all to us in Cambridge for our apologetic course, and you'll see the brochures downstairs. Okay, the point I was making is that it's not essential, but look what happened in just a single little community in terms of apologetics and the effect it's had. Secondly, not as if these little communities need to displace the local church or the preaching of the Bible. Expository preaching of the whole of Scripture, nor evangelism. Not as if these little communities, these models, should displace the local church. And finally, not as if they need to be permanent. Not as if they need to be permanent. One of our big challenges as Labrie, which we will never outlive, is to see ourselves as not necessarily permanent. And one of the things Schaefer labored was, maybe we have been brought into existence by God for a short little period of time. The only community that is guaranteed in existence right through till the coming again of the Lord is the church, the local church. So he insisted, and we have continued to insist, that anyone in Labrie has to be a member of a local church. And every year it's list read out in the members' meeting whose church, who belongs to which church, simply because we're trying to hold on to this principle that it is the church that is the institution God has given up until the second coming of Christ. But my point is, not as if then it means that you cannot have any other institutions. So you have Christian hospitals, Christian schools, etc., etc. And my point is, apologetic community, if they are called by God, could be wonderfully effective in this present moment. So let me just share with you my dream and mention a few other alternatives. I mean, they're all here, they're represented. It is so encouraging to have Peter Saunders, Christian Medical Fellowship, Michael Ravsden, what are their courses? Conversational apologetics, something like that, yeah. And Richard Cunningham is doing his own thing, and there are others too. I mean, Lars is involved here in a similar kind of a thing. It is so encouraging to see these things. And I just say, there is no one model. Let us be imaginative. And the secret comes back, and maybe there's nothing more important that I can say in all of this, is actually we're not talking, when we talk about apologetics, about intellectual things primarily. We are talking primarily, and this is the sine qua non. If you don't have this, you don't have it. That is spirituality, true spirituality. If we're seeking God's leading, He will lead the right people to the right things, to the right models, the imaginative constructions that are going to meet the need. Okay. So it all has to be set within that context. And these people have been led that way. Richard, Michael, Ramsden, etc. Wonderful. I'm so encouraged. This whole conference is something which has emerged out of that. Okay. But my dream, and I'm not suggesting now that this needs to be the right thing, but ever since I've been in Libreville, I've longed that churches would see the importance of this. That you wouldn't have to trek out to some conference or go to Libreville in the country or wherever, but that they would join together for the same purpose, namely to create a little community. It doesn't have to look like Libreville or Richard's thing or whatever. It can be its own thing, but probably near a university to take on the cultural ideas, okay, raise up a new generation, and where they would put money into funding a community of 3 or 4 or 5 people, maybe a couple of single workers, yeah, and they would have a place which could be a center in which there would be an open door, people coming in, you know, welcomed, the human, the personal, not the virtual, the individual. Are individuals precious? Yes. And when they can then ask their own personal questions, not necessarily the textbook questions. I've got this problem. Is there an answer? Like I did when I arrived at Libreville. It was so exciting, you know, to find that Christianity was really true. I cannot tell you. And then at the same time, just this feeling of lament that for so many years I had been left thinking that it wasn't really true, and that it was really just an experience of some sort which people in the church had, and where you could never get any answers to these bigger questions. So personal, creative. By creative, I mean not just having creativity, art, beauty, etc., but imaginative things. Staging debates or lectures or whatever the need is there, you know, that will answer the need. And then facilities, you know, like videos, computers, audio material that people could listen to. Jock McGregor, who's here, arrived at Libreville, and he was on his way to pick fruit in the south of France. And somebody had said to him in South Africa, "Hey, Jock, you should get along to that place." So he turns up, and everyone's so busy, because it's not a community that's living for itself. It's a community, and that's, you know, this, as I said earlier, sacrifice, service, and and suffering. I mean, the community is not living for itself, but to serve the people who come. Anyway, so many people, too many people, no one to see Job. Job, you know, there's an audio outlet up there in the chalet up the road. Just go along there and just, you know, take your pick. Just take the audios that you think are interesting. He sat down and he listened to those audios. And they just changed his life. Just that little thing. He hadn't even spoken to anyone, you know, about his question. And so a situation like that, do you all pick up what I'm saying? Because I feel that if we could do this throughout all the universities, just say in the UK, but also in Europe, if you could have situations like this, which built up, here is the critical thing, which built up continuity, so not just people just, you know, in and out 1 year, 2 years, but actually build up continuity and credibility, confidence, trust, so that student A or Mrs. B from the church could say, hey, come along with me. You know, these folk might be able to answer your question. And you have a meal. I think as it continued, it would become something of tremendous value, both to the church in the training of apologists, okay? Going back to my first point, that if the church could do that, that is the ideal. But secondly, that it would be an outreach to many who right now would never darken, you know, the entrance of a church. Guys for whom, you know, go to a service? And who they would just come in and they'd ask their questions. And that requires courage. It requires long-term commitment, you know, in terms of onward discussion. So anyway, I'm giving you my dream. I've done. We've got 40 minutes, which I not as much as I'd hoped for, but you know, guys, if you don't like the noise of this thing, I insisted this morning we open the doors and switch that off. But if I'm up to you. It's up to you. If we open the doors, it should be quiet enough, and then we don't have to work against that machine. Could you just turn it down, Tom? That would be great. Okay, who would like to lead off in terms of? Yes. Yeah, they're just outside the door there, Chris, on the left. Thank you. Lovely. Now we'll make ourselves comfortable. Ooh, there we go. I've lost the lid of this thing, if anyone can see it. Oh, there it is. Thank you, sir. Okay. Now, let this just be as wide-ranging as you like in terms of, you know, sorry, that was a bit of a long speech there. But, I mean, we've got Lars here who's done one aspect of all of this, and Lars, you might like to contribute. Miro is involved with SEN, SEN in Slovakia, and that's very exciting. And they've got this training program which is going on, and outreach in a sense. So, and then others of you might have things. So, but we don't have to do that. We could maybe go in a totally different direction.
Well, thank you, Alan, for sharing. Especially your dream towards the end of it, that was something that was worth pondering and worth reflecting. Just to go back to your first point, you know, about community in general.
Yeah.
One of the things I'm doing is training journalists.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking about, you know, how, of course, following on from McIntyre talks about virtue, ethics, and that is actually being. It's also interesting to think about the different professional groups, how they consist, you know, they actually constitute communities. Like
giving us an example.
I mean, journalists, lawyers, artists, either, and what are the values that are being promoted within such a constituency?
Are you suggesting, sorry, go ahead. Look.
Yeah. And take the example of a young journalist joining a media organization, you know, about a newspaper, and then entering that and becoming completely absorbed into the whole thing, being swallowed into the system.
Right, right.
There's just been a very thorough investigation of a specific case in Norway concerning the mistreatment of one individual who actually committed suicide, partly because of, he was previously a senior minister in cabinet in Norway.
He was what?
Minister.
Okay.
Of the cabinet.
Oh, wow.
The previous cabinet.
Yeah.
And he's actually committed suicide, partly due to pressures from the media. And one thing that was said by the people doing this analysis was that everyone was running in the same direction. There was no one who dared to stand up and to have the courage, as he said, to have the commitment to do something different.
Right.
I mean, this is on the general community level, but it's significant, I think. What are the values that characterize a community? Either it's a professional community or a personal community.
Now, can I relate this to what I'm saying? And it just make sure I've understood you. Now, are you saying that in addition to the apologetic community that I've been describing, there is actually another kind of community that would be very helpful, which is also apologetic in a sense, and that is that if you had the journalists being in a relationship together in which they could build up a confidence intellectually, an understanding of their métier, of the world of the media and the issues of the day, etc., that itself could become an apologetic community? Not in the way of,
no.
Like I was describing, of welcoming, but no. Spell it out a bit more.
Just picking up on your first theme on communities in general.
Communities in general, right. Okay.
Of course, if Christians who belong to the same professional setting could come together and encourage each other, what are the issues, the implications of our Christian faith?
Right.
Specific work.
There have been examples of that, haven't there? I mean, like in England, the UCCF, that's the student work, has had all kinds of branches where they've had historians and medics, etc., etc. Anyone like to comment on that further? Lawyers Christian Fellowship.
Underestimate the difficulties, I speak as a lawyer, but the Lawyers Christian Fellowship in Britain, basically, has been becoming more vibrant.
Yes, I'm very thankful to hear about that.
And I think part of what it has been doing has been equipping lawyers for opportunities for service that may arise out of their particular disciplines. I think that in terms of challenging some of the attitudes that lawyers have. There seems to be these communities who do two things. One is you can sustain and support Christians, you may find themselves in a different environment,
right.
A challenging environment. But in terms of taking Christian presence, whether that be just an individual or within a firm, and challenging the assumptions of another firm, of the environment in which they live, there may be scope. It's the question, isn't it, of whether you can do that within existing structures of maybe a big firm of 500 people, whether you have to say, we're going to go and do our law a different way, in a different place.
That's
and
right.
There are Christian law firms.
Who do that? Mm. That's right, yes. Well, I agree with you. Well, I think this, going back to my first point, there are these two two elements, that these two forces at work. And the second is devastating in its effect. And so people are longing for community. They feel overwhelmed in these big situations. But also, too, the housewives feel overwhelmed. You know, like my daughter, she's just struggling at the moment with the whole question of a working mother, for example, if they're short of money. Do you have to have two incomes? And that kind of thing. So that's one thing. Another pressure would be, I've got to trek around the town and take my kids over there to school, you know, all this kind of thing. So just responding to what you said, clearly there is a need of community per se, just simply. And that can be done in all kinds of ways. I personally think that what McIntyre said at the end is absolutely right. We are looking for a new Benedict within the church, both to help create these communities which become models, which can influence the whole culture, which is what they did, but also to sort of point the way to help people to recover community in their own situation so that they don't feel like they're just caught up in a tidal wave. And obviously a person like Morris Berman there, you know, not even a Christian, and the downsizing, is that what you call it in the States, the downsizing movement in the States and so on. All of this is a cry from the heart. And I just feel like this is the time to pray for people who would be imaginative into that. What distresses me is that so many times the evangelical churches haven't even started to think about it. I mean, for example, I'm in Cambridge, and we have an ideal situation to create really good alternative transport and end the dominance of the motor car. Everyone realizes that. Okay. And I belong to a thing called the Cambridge Cycling Campaign. I nearly, just to impress you guys, brought along my sweatshirt, which I wear from time to time. But I don't know of a single church in Cambridge that would think this was important. And yet, depending on it, is the woman who has to trek with her car, even though we have an organization called Sustrans, Sustainable Transport, which is operating throughout the whole country and has a project called Safe Routes to School. So they've got lottery money, government money to actually do this. Where are the Christians? Oh, this is not important.
Yeah, as you were speaking in the earlier part, a thought that occurred to me was that I also come from Cambridge, so there's something important that within our some of our evangelical churches, at least, there is a deep-seated fear of forsaking the gospel
for
social action. Because
that's right.
Historically, there have been occasions, and in particular, Cambridge has, in its own recent, I have asked for several decades, history, a time where, in a sense, preserving evangelical convictions
about
the cross and the importance of substitutionary atonement and evangelism as a crucial priority was vital. But what in fact I think happens is that instead of seeing that the issue is Christ Lord of all, it's always evangelism matters, social action doesn't. And that's the wrong, in a sense, that's the wrong question. The question is Christ pertinent to all areas of
that's
life?
That's right, that's right,
And how wonderful is that?
You all realize where we are, guys, and some of you have been quiet, so please, you know, do feel very free, but we're talking about community, just community. We're not talking about apologetic communities. Well, I think...
What is the difference, for example, in community and fellowship?
Community and fellowship. Good question.
I'm not sure if you understand these English terms properly.
Yes. Yes.
But it's, if I'm understanding correctly, people coming for a limited period, generally speaking, later.
Yeah.
Then it's more kind of, okay, whole life is shared and you prep those things to discuss, whatever.
It's a good question.
So we have also community settings where you didn't work together or communication together. Maybe for a period of time, maybe for a long period of time. So and then I know communities like in Austria where I live, where especially more in a Catholic setting, coming from this monastic idea where people maybe build a whole street,
yes,
live there together, but they have jobs, you know. They have jobs all over in different spheres. But they live together closely, share lives this way. I mean, I see hundreds of different models there.
Right, right.
Are you thinking mostly of the Le Brie
model? No, no, no. Please don't misunderstand me, guys. I'm not advocating Le Brie as a model in terms of for the culture as a whole. That's why I stress the local church, okay? But there is no one definition of community, and societies are elastic. You know, they can work in different combinations under certain stresses, under certain developments, natural developments, creative developments. Okay, but where I see a difference is where all of these guys are focused. You know, that is that there has been this change in the way society as a whole works, so that you have this second influence now actually destroying what was previously considered community, simply because people are traveling such distances, they aren't in an area long enough to know anyone else in the area, so the children can't play with people next door because what's the point? You know, the children are going to go away. Things like that. So what I would like to introduce is the discussion. There was a natural community simply because of the limitations, physical limitations, that you were all in one area. And I'm not advocating that we should go back. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying the inventions of all of these things was wrong, but simply that now, where previously it did exist naturally, now it can only exist with very great difficulty. And that's the thing that's a great struggle for me. So, for example, if you go to most churches now, you find people are traveling quite large distances. They have massive car parks. And yet in their own areas from which they've come, they would probably not know very many folk around. And so there's no community there. Then, of course, there are other factors quite outside of their control, in a sense, and that is that the big supermarkets in England, Tesco, Sainsbury's, you've got your equivalent, and then everyone jumps in a car and then goes to that, and so you lose the little shop across the road. We have a little shop across the road. No one's going, will they survive? We have a post office there. Will it survive? And these are the sorts of factors. Then you introduce things like, you know, the division of a city, a beautiful city, by a massive great highway. So, you know, how do you have community in that kind of environment? These are the sorts of dilemmas. Now, I'm not saying that there is an ideal form of a community, but it is a problem. And it is partly this that has created the situation where people are having more and more virtual community and less real community. That, it seems to me, should be anathema to a Christian, where Jesus goes and he just talks to the woman by the well. She is important. He goes and he helps the widow of Nain. Her son's died. That's the kind of a thing. So I know it can't be defined, you know, precisely, nor is there an absolute model, an ideal model. Yet we clearly have got a situation which is a crisis. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, or maybe a question could be rephrased. What would be, how can I say, the minimum of shared life that you would call a community?
Yeah.
In the end? Because it's about shared life somehow.
Shared life, it is, that's right. Shared life.
We meet once a week in a journalist's grouping where we exchange ideas.
Exactly.
At
the very least, all I would say, at the very least, is that the idea first has got to come into our heads, This is important. Secondly, it has to be made a priority, not just by the church, but by us, individuals, first of all, and then for our family's sake, and then secondly, for the sake of the people around whom we, with whom we live. Now, guys, I don't want to force the discussion in any particular direction, but we have focused on community, number one. We haven't touched, two, apologetics, nor have we really dealt with apologetic communities. That's okay by me. I'm just so we know where we are, sir.
I just wanted to sort of open up further the whole issue of relationship between such a community and church.
Yeah.
In that,
you mean one of my models,
is
that
called? Yes,
yeah, okay.
In that it seems to set up a model that can be replicated, but not necessarily a model that can easily be replicated in the church. And isn't there a danger of pursuing, if we look at the New Testament and we're looking for community, we find it in the church.
Yeah.
So if the failure is in the church, if it's a failure of the churches, local churches, I'm speaking as a church pastor.
Yeah.
If it's the failure of the local church to be the community that it should be,
yeah, yeah,
then do we invest our energies into separate communities that could be multiplied and copied but not within the church?
Yeah.
Or is it actually the priority to focus the energy into the churches to actually solve the problem where the problem is?
Would anyone like to comment on that? Yes, Larry.
Are you talking about decentralization of the church? Like maybe cell group?
I don't know what the solution is. What I'm saying is, if we say that,
yeah,
the way society is going, it's all the more need for community, desperate need for Christians to recover community,
yes, yes,
and for apologetic reasons as well. And if the New Testament tells us the locus of that community should be the local church, then should we aim straight at the target of the local church? And by whatever the means is, how do we get there, whatever is needed, and then whatever the structures needed, but we aim for targets directly of the local church, rather than by some other roundabout route, which is setting up alternative communities, which is then trying to transpose the needs of the churches.
Okay, we'll go ahead, Tim.
An issue I think that can sometimes arise in the context of a church's life and the role of the pastor is that and others in the leadership, is that it's a commonplace that Christians would be taught to love one another.
Yeah.
But it would be very, very rare, I suspect, for a pastor in an address or a home group in a discussion to discuss the question, should I commute to a job?
Yeah.
A lot of people,
yeah,
in Cambridge travel an hour and a half from the train,
yeah,
I did it for 3 years, to London. How does that impact? I mean, clearly,
yeah,
you earn a lot more money if you go,
yeah,
to London generally, but it takes me out of Cambridge,
yeah,
my family, my church, 21 hours a week.
Yeah.
How do I evaluate that against the criteria of the club? And there's not, you know, there won't be a right or wrong answer to that question, but it may not be even something that people are asking a question about.
Well, I suppose what I'm saying is, do you try and get the question to be asked, but perhaps it should be asked in the church or somewhere else? So, as a local church pastor, do I go back and say to the other local evangelical churches that we're in fellowship with, hey, what we should do is invest some resources in,
yeah,
setting up a community,
yeah,
where there'll be the 3-4 people that you've suggested,
yeah, yeah,
even going down,
right,
that,
right,
period.
Right.
That, you can see that would be very, very valuable to,
yeah,
do that. Or should I be going back and saying, like, what I need to do is start doing something, so every Saturday night saying, it's going to be open house, it's going to be food, encourage,
yeah,
many people from the church dropping in and getting those sort of questions, whether there's the big apologetic questions or whether the practical questions which make me to work, to be knocked around within the context of fellowship together in the church.
Nick,
I
don't see it as an either or, you know, that you have to do the one and then not do the other. It seems to me there ought to be both going on. That is, that just like Christopher has used the example of raising questions in relation to community, now meaning by community just the general problem of community, commuting and children going to school on bikes, you know, those kind of things. There are those general questions. They should be raised in the church. But also, too, now, the apologetic issues. And you're opening your house, having discussions. If the church can do it, if the pastor can bring the church behind him to do that, and they have the equipment, the people to do it, who've been trained, do it. That, it seems to me, if we could transform our churches so that people, you know, on block within the church, I don't mean they could all do it to the same level, but where you had a facility within the church, the local church, to do it, that would be marvelous. But my dilemma is, as I look at the church and I see this huge gap, you remember, that I drew here, because people haven't been talking about these issues, what do you say to someone who says, you know, what, how do I know that Christianity is true? Basic question. Okay. You don't want to worry about that. You know, so we've been so far away from the answering of questions that therefore it's a time problem, partly, and a skill problem, and that we just haven't got the people. Therefore, I say, not as an ideal, remember I said it doesn't have to be this way, but just to create a model, then people say, oh, I get what you mean. People get converted this way. You know, Nancy Piercy becomes a Christian and then writes books that thousands and thousands of people read, like C.S. Lewis. It's like, oh, hey, man, let's do it, you know. And so I see it as a both and, not as an either or. And wherever you are, that's why I stress this thing of the leadership of the Holy Spirit. If you're in a different position than, say, one of you guys in the church that you're in, you know, go for it. If you could do it. Sorry, you wanted to come back.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's see the real options is mutually exclusive. I suppose what I'm saying is I think it's important not to lose sight of what should be the real target, the ultimate target
of
actually your churches with properly function.
Yes.
Community.
I agree.
Because whatever you do in terms of things that are outside the church, outside the church, that ultimately has a much lower impact, or has a very limited impact, unless it actually impacts the churches and changes what's happening in the churches. Because that's where the majority
But Nick,
of
can
I feel like I've heard Ramon slightly differently, even in the context of the Baptist dream.
Okay.
I think I've heard Ramon in terms of saying, well, perhaps within a church's fellowship, there might be within that, just in the same way that you might have a small team who consider their ministry particularly to be among the youth.
Yes.
You might have a group of people who dedicate themselves to being outward facing and open to whosoever they wish to visit.
Yes.
To, in some sense, engage with the life of the church.
That's
and the life of the mind simultaneously.
That's right.
So it's a part of the church, all the whole church would be outward facing, but this would require a particular level of commitment and a particular blend of skills. I don't know, maybe I missed that.
But no, thank you, Christopher. That's exactly what I meant. But I see the danger of a church feeling like it has to become an apologetic community in the sense that the pastor starts doing apologetics from the pulpit. That is a no-no in my view. Because that is just the wrong context. And when you read the book of Acts, and I left a lot of stuff out of my notes, but when you read the book of Acts, you have Paul then staying for a long period of time. And it says he had discussions for a year and a half in the hall of Tyrannus when he was in Ephesus. Well, he is not preaching on the Sabbath or the Sunday, whatever you call it, to all the churches, the men, the women, and the children, in the same way that he's having discussions in the hall of Tyrannus. One isn't told exactly what he was doing, but clearly, I mean, the guy was, I mean, you just have to read Colossians, Ephesians. I mean, Festus shouts out in the courtroom, Paul, your great learning is turning you mad. You know, he doesn't say you're an idiot. He sees that this guy is, you know, and he's knocking the issues, and he tackles them right there in the courtyard. The Sadducees is against the Pharisees, you know. So, and the Roman governor sees this. So my point is that the church has to guard this, the centrality of the Bible, the preaching of, so that everyone hears it and understands it, okay? rather like Don was taking Genesis this morning. You know, that's the function. Now, I personally believe that if you don't attend to the apologetic issues, and you have what I called this morning sola scriptura in vacuo, you know, this precious principle, the Bible only, but it's in a total vacuum, just sort of up there in space. What Nigel Cameron calls Bible world, you know, yeah, like that's exactly my reaction. Like Disney World, completely unrelated. Okay, if the preacher doesn't have in his mind the big issues that actually the people do have, yeah, I mean, we're in Cambridge, for example. We've got these dons and, you know, and highly capable people working in the technology field, science park, etc., etc., and you too here. In this country and all over Europe. If you've got these people and the preaching never touches on them, even obliquely, then it seems to me our preaching is going to be less biblical than it ought to be. Because the biblical preaching is always keeping people in touch with reality, the whole thing. And so when you find Paul preaching, you'll find that that is coming in. You
know, he's bringing...
No. I'm just trying to say the other. I'm just trying to guard the fact that the church has to be careful how it did it. But if the church could, let's say, lay on something like this, like I've written to all the pastors that I know that have been in touch with us in the Cambridge area, and I said, hey, guys, we did this thing with students, which they really appreciated, called the Big Picture Group. And incidentally, just look out for how many times you see this phrase, big picture, coming up now. I mean, there was a leader article in the local paper, in the national press about, 6 months ago. And they had all the leading historians in England, Simon Schramm and Neil Ferguson, Oxford, you know, and so on, David Starkey. And the phrase, the big picture, kept coming in. In other words, even the non-Christians are sensing the need to give people a big picture. And if a church could do that, and we're saying, listen, we'll come for four nights, four evenings, that's all, nothing more, and just give you guys a taste of what it means to, and then some of the material that I was dealing with this morning, you know, that is in the notes that you've got there from the leadership and society topic, and then just deal with it. And the church should do that. That would be easy. It's not infringing upon the primacy of Scripture and the exposition of Scripture. It's not infringing upon Bible studies and the church and the local groups, etc. But it's taking care of the apologetic need. Do you see? So they're all kind of, we've got to be imaginative. Yeah. But you do need personnel who've thought about it. You know, Paul had thought about it a lot, and that's why none of his letters is easy. So, yes. Has anyone not said anything? Yeah, and you haven't said anything. Are you itching to say something?
Patty? I have one thing.
You have, go for it. Excuse me, sir. I'd like to just...
I am working in Spain, and as I'm listening to this discussion, I'm thinking that the Holy Spirit has been working in Spain for a long time. Sharing life with them that way. But I think my thought as I'm listening to this is just that I love the idea, and it's so tasty to me because I needed that to be converted too. But the people that I'm spending my time with need probably one gigantic step backwards from the point of an apologetic
community.
Because
yeah.
Not in the community where there's a big grocery store where people are getting in cars, and we do sit around in bars a lot and just chat and have coffee. But the culture is such that we don't talk about those things. And there are certain things that you just talk about with your family, is what I found among.
Well, actually, we've got a friend. Let me just give you an example. She extraordinary family, but she decided to do it. theological degree, so she did that in England. And now her children have grown up, and they're bringing their friends back, university. Okay? And she is finding that the theological training she had and the good Bible teaching in the churches has left her with very little idea of how you actually break through to confront the non-Christian world. You know, one of the things that I discovered in that first meeting with Schaefer was that far from me needing to feel embarrassed about my faith, it's the other guys, the humanists or whoever else, who need to be embarrassed about their faith because it just don't make any sense at all. And that switch is absolutely vital. Not that you then come in, you know, the very hard, and this is why I went back, you know, to this thing of true spirituality, the whole mentality with which you do the thing, and gentleness, and taking time, forming relations. But anyway, I just feel like we've lost huge areas of opportunity when the culture is so hungry, you know, to be able to say, and I think it does involve an understanding of what I call the epistemological lie, and then be able to throw in a little comment, you know, which gets a bit, oh, never thought about that. And these are the sorts of things. They're not tricks. They are actually taken straight out of the Word of God. So, Paul, we're going to quit in a few minutes, but I would argue that nothing in Schaefer is original. It is all straight out of the Scriptures. And what we did, the only thing about his originality, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but was that he simply took the Scriptures and then applied them. He recovered something which we had lost. The whole thing of, you know, the challenge of the non-Christian thought, Romans 1. Thinking themselves to be wise, that's an intellectual idea, they became fools. How? He just argues it all the way through. You know, because the invisible things of God are clearly seen in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. How? Morally? He hasn't got to that yet. Intellectually, they are without excuse. They're going to stand before him at the end and they will have nothing to say. So he actually uses that phrase. Their mouths will be stopped. They'll have no good reason to say, I didn't know, whatever. Okay. Then he comes to the moral question. So that's all that Schaefer was doing, and applying it to this sad story of how, to use Don's words, which were so powerful in terms of idolatry, the de-godding of God, just turn away from God. Yeah, we must go. But I think that that just finished on that note. I just think that that is something which we have lost and we have to recover. Shall we pray? Father, please help us now as we are so conscious of our need in relation to the way that the society in which we live is so far, like Anne's just said, people just never even think about this, that you would please, Lord, help us. Have mercy on us, Lord, in all of our weaknesses and failures. Have mercy on them. And for your great glory, Lord, please raise up those who will be able to speak with authority, as at the time of the Reformation, as in the early church, to turn around an entire civilization. We pray this and pray that you'll bless us now in our meal and our conversations for the rest of today. For Jesus' sake, amen.